Hello everybody, welcome to lecture number two. I want to mention, I was mentioning it a bit to Danny Sanchez and Catherine before, next week I'll be coming back from the Austrian conference at the Mises Institute. They want me to stay on an extra day, so I won't be back in time for the regular lecture. So next week, the lecture will be on Wednesday at this time and not Tuesday. And then after that, we'll be going back to the Tuesday lecture. Now, I should mention, I put out a quiz. Some of you have taken that. I was very happy to see, at least last time I checked, that everyone who took the quiz got 100% right on the quiz. This is encouraging. I was very glad to see that. Now, in the section we have to deal with today, Mises covers some of the most fundamental points in his entire social philosophy and view of economics. So this is a particularly important lecture because if we can get the basic concepts here, we'll have gotten something that's really important in understanding Mises. I want to start off with what seems to be a paradox in that Mises is obviously very strongly committed to the free market. I think if you read Human Action or any of his other work, he's not one to stand on the fence as far as what he favors. No one could read any of his books and doubt his devotion to the free market. But he also says that praxeology, which is its general science of human action, which economics is the best developed subpart, is value free. That's to say, economics doesn't make any value claims, like saying free market is a good thing, or people should support the free market. So we want to ask, is this a contradiction? Is Mises in trouble here? Because he says he's very strongly committed to the free market, but at the same time, economics, praxeology is value free. Is that a contradiction? Now, does anybody think, have any view on that? Does it seem to you that's a contradiction? Does anybody think it is? Well, I guess now I was hoping somebody. Now, Ryan says that Thoreau could live a barter life out of the woods as long as he doesn't violate non-aggression principle. Well, that's a very good point, Ryan. You could do that, but I mean, the free market wouldn't stop people from engaging in barter. But the apparent contradiction is Mises says economics is value free, but he seems to be giving a lot of value judgments himself. And the answer is it isn't very hard to figure out, but that it isn't a contradiction because Mises can have all sorts of value judgments that he wants, but it doesn't follow that there's any contradiction unless these value judgments are part of economics. It would be a contradiction if, say, Mises said, economics makes no value judgments, and he also said it's part of economics that we ought to establish a free market if one doesn't already exist, or we ought to support the free market. That would be a contradiction because you'd be saying at the same time that the science of economics is value free, and then it includes statements of value in it. But it isn't a contradiction if it just happens that the economist, in this case Mises, has value judgments as long as he doesn't put them into the economic theory itself. So Mises says, economics does not imply liberalism or any other ethical or political system. And we should say, when he's talking about liberalism, he doesn't mean what people very often mean by that term today, where a liberal would be someone who is on the left, who perhaps falls short of outright socialism, but favors various welfare state measures. Say, we could say President Obama is a liberal in the modern sense. But this isn't what Mises means. When he talks about liberalism, he means classical liberalism, 19th century liberalism, which is support for the free market. So Mises is a classical liberal, but would definitely not be a liberal as the term is used in contemporary American politics. So he says, economics doesn't imply liberalism, doesn't imply that we ought to establish the free market. It doesn't imply any other system. Economics is value free. So does it follow from that, those two claims, that economics is value free and Mises himself as a classical liberal, that there's no relation at all between economics and the value commitments Mises held, namely strong devotion to the free market? Are they just independent matters? That's to say, just as you could find, say, somebody could be an economist and like or dislike modern art, there'd be no relation between the two of them. So is that the state of affairs in play between classical liberalism and economics, that the two just have no relation? And Mises says no, and this I think is a very valuable point he makes. If you hold economics as value free, that it doesn't have value judgments of its own, it can make claims that are relevant to values judgments. It can say, if you want material prosperity, you should establish the free market. Or you could say, the free market is the way to get material prosperity, of course, relative to the resources in a particular society. So this is not, if you say, if you want material prosperity, you should establish a free market, this isn't a normative statement. This isn't a value judgment saying this free market is a good thing or a judgment that you should, in some absolute sense of the word, should favor the free market. If it were that, then it would be a value judgment. But this is a descriptive thing. It's just saying, here's how you should, what you should do if you want to establish prosperity. And I see a question here from Bob, making personal judgments not need to interfere with the dispassionate objective analysis of economic issues. Correct. Yes, that's right. I mean, even if you think that ethical judgments are more than personal preferences, they're still different from economics. But here, the key point is that if you have these hypothetical judgments, say, if you want material prosperity, you should do this, or if you want something else, you should do such and such. That isn't a value judgment. That's just a statement that says, here's how you can attain this particular goal. So that's a value-free statement. Somebody who hated material prosperity could say, if you want material prosperity, establish a free market, but I don't want material prosperity. So it wouldn't imply any particular commitment to favoring or opposing anything. It's just a hypothetical statement. Now, Mises, though, goes further, and here he's still within economic theory. Remember, he separates that economics is value free, so economics won't be making any value judgments. And he says it isn't a value judgment to say if you want material prosperity, you should favor the free market. That's a factual claim. That's regardless of how you feel about material prosperity, whether you like it or don't like it, that's the way to get it. Now he goes further and he says most people do in fact want material prosperity. So what he's claiming here is that the hypothetical judgment he's just made, if you want material prosperity, you should support the free market, is very relevant to the actual preferences people have. We could imagine other hypothetical imperative, as they're called, hypothetical saying, if you want to destroy the planet as fast as you can, then you should start a nuclear war immediately. That wouldn't be a value judgment either, because that would be just saying, here is how you can destroy the planet as fast as you can, or destroy all human life as fast as you can. But almost no one would favor that, so that hypothetical judgment wouldn't be relevant to most people. But here, Mises has a statement that he says is one that is very relevant to what people want. He said most people do want material prosperity. So then this value judgment, I mean this not factual judgment, excuse me, I'm falling into just a mistake. I've been spending the past time worrying that this is not a value judgment. So the descriptive statement, if you want material prosperity, you should establish the free market, is very relevant to the preferences most people have. Now, we can imagine at this point an objection that there's some people who say, aren't there values higher than money or material prosperity, such as the classical philosophy one, the true, the good, and the beautiful, aren't they higher than money? Why should those values be subordinated to the pursuit of material gain? So the objection would be, well, Mises is going to say everybody wants material prosperity, but he's neglecting, and then if he says, since you want this, then you should have the free market, but he's neglecting the possibility that there are other values that people rank higher than material prosperity. So if you accept what Mises said, that wouldn't give you a very good reason to establish the free market, because it might turn out these higher values are best realized by not promoting material prosperity. So see what the objection there is. Mises seems like he's trying to get a value judgment, sort of sneak in support for the free market without putting in a value judgment, because he says, I'm not making a value judgment, all I'm saying is if you want material prosperity, you should support the free market. And then it just turns out most people do want that. And then this objection is, well, what if about higher values in the market? So even if you're right that the market will promote material prosperity, maybe these higher values will best be promoted with some other system. Mises has two responses to this objection. Remember, the objection is that he's neglected these higher values. So if he wants to argue, says, look, the free market is the best way, the way to obtain material prosperity, that's a descriptive statement, and most people, in fact, do want material prosperity, so then people will then judge we should support the free market. The objection is, well, what about other values that are supposed to be higher than material prosperity? And Mises says, he asks, well, under what conditions do these higher values flourish? He suggests that, in fact, they flourish to a greater extent in wealthy societies than in poor ones. If we think of, say the 19th century was a great period for culture. We had great music and art, but was also a very prosperous time. So why would we think there's any conflict between these higher values and material prosperity? And he also notes that supporters of these higher values don't generally sell them as harmful to prosperity. So people say their various, he's very concerned in, elsewhere in the book, with certain religious doctrines that tell people you shouldn't concentrate on making as much money as you can. Remember, the love of money is the root of all evil, as we've been told. So he notes that although there are people who say that, what they don't tell the people, you'll be very happy to know that you're going to be very poor if you put the precepts we favor into action, that even those who advance these higher values, say money and material prosperity isn't that important, don't themselves say, we should favor these policies just because they'll keep you poor. There are people who held such views, but they haven't been very popular. Now you might say, well, why does any of this matter in this sense? Even if doctrines say that poverty is desirable wouldn't get very many votes, that they'd be rejected by most people. Maybe they're right anyway. Maybe people aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Maybe there's some ethical imperative that says, well, we ought to just concentrate, say, on contemplating the truth. We should get, we shouldn't concentrate on business. There was an American philosopher who was quite an interesting writer, not too well known, named Elijah Jordan, wrote a book called Business Be Damned. It's not too hard to figure out what his attitude was to the market. So supposing someone said to him, look, most people don't agree with you, that wouldn't have bothered him. So what would Mises say to that? The very important point is that Mises wouldn't say, look, Mr. Jordan and other people like him, maybe Gandhi, are taking the wrong view. They just have a distorted view of values, that true values are that material prosperity is indeed good. But he isn't saying that. What Mises is concerned with is what people do value, not what they ought to value from some external perspective to their personal value. It should be personal value there rather than just value. So what Mises is saying is, if you want to say that people have the wrong values, go ahead, but I'm not interested in that. I'm just interested in what people do want, and they in fact want material prosperity, so other things are going to be, the judgment that they ought to establish a free market, given they want this, is going to be very relevant to them. Now, somebody could say, oh, okay, we favor material prosperity, but then we also favor some kind of redistribution to the poor, and then Mises would argue against that, generally, that those measures tend not to work. So that would be how he'd handle that response. After he deals with this relation between economics and liberalism, he turns to another very important topic that's not strictly part, or isn't at all part of economics, is the relation between religion and liberalism. Remember, he's using liberalism to mean classical liberalism. Now, is classical liberalism anti-religious? If you believe in the free market, does it follow that you can't believe in God or can't be a member of a church or organized religion? Mises says, no, those two things don't follow. Yeah, he emphasizes that liberalism is based entirely on reason, not faith. According to classical liberalism, it's objectively true that the free market will lead to greater productivity than rival systems. Say, Mises can show in his calculation argument that a socialist economy can't work. So this isn't, when he says this, his argument is either right or wrong. Of course, I think it's right, but regardless of whether his argument is right, he's arguing purely from by reason. He's saying here are some premises that we can see to be true, and certain conclusions follow from them. He isn't claiming that he has access to some kind of non-rational source of knowledge. He isn't claiming that God told him that the free market is the best system. It would be rather unusual if he were to claim that God had told him that, because he doesn't believe in God, so it wouldn't be clear who would be telling him that. But that he rejects for classical, he says classical liberalism doesn't involve any appeal to non-rational source of knowledge. Now, he calls doctrines of society that do appeal to non-rational sources of knowledge theocratic. That's a somewhat unusual use of the word theocracy. Theocracy means a, usually taking a government run in accord with God's law. So you would have, in a theocratic view, you have a particular view of what God's law is, and then you'd, if you ran the society on that basis, then you'd have a theocracy. Now, some people use the word, so it would have to be, theocracy would be a government by a priests or a particular religious class, but that isn't actually what the word originally meant or started off as meaning. The word theocracy is a rule according to God's law, so you could hold a view that God's law doesn't require rule by a special priestly class and still believe in theocracy. But the point that's relevant for us now is that Mises is using the word in a different way. So you can be believe in theocracy according to Mises even if you don't believe in God at all, because he counts as theocratic any appeal to special non-rational knowledge. For example, a claim that some person or group can discern the trend of history. For example, the communist movement in the 20th century, beginning with the Lenin's Bolshevik Party, claimed that the party had special knowledge of the way history was going. The party could really interpret what the correct program would be to bring about the coming of the next stage of history, which was socialism. And Mises, of course, the communists were very strongly atheist, but Mises counts what they said as theocratic because he thinks that they were appealing to some kind of non-rational source. They said, we have special insight into the trends of history. It's not that we can come up with deductive arguments based on premises that everyone would find reasonable and accept that our views are correct. It's just, no, you have to accept that the party, and particularly the party leader, whether Lenin or Stalin or Mao or whoever's in charge, has special insight into what's happening. So Mises' concept is theocratic. Now here, I think his views have an interesting parallel with those of his student, Eric Voegelin, because what Voegelin stressed in his books on history, you can look at the New Science of Politics, especially his very good short account of Voegelin's views, is that there are various movements that he called Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, where groups claim special insight into the world or into history, not based on reason. So there's a interesting parallel, I didn't note this down in the slide, between Mises' view of theocracy and Voegelin on Gnosticism. I'm not going to put that on the quiz, it's a bit arcane perhaps, but I thought it's an interesting thing to note, particularly for those, if any of you are interested in Voegelin, who after all was Mises' student, that he has a similar view. Now, from Mises' a very negative attitude to theocracy, you might think he was opposed to religion, but he wasn't. He points out that theocracy is not the same as religion, not only because you could have theocratic views that are not religious, say, just as the communist view. The communists don't believe in God, but they count as theocratic for Mises because they say that we can have special access to the, certain people can have special access to the truth about history, the truth about society, that's not based on reason. So you could have there a theocracy that wasn't religious, but he thinks you could also have religions that aren't theocratic. Now you might wonder, well, how is that possible? Because after all, aren't religions based on faith? So how could you, isn't religion necessarily appealing to some kind of source such as a revelation that isn't fully based on reason? So then how can Mises say that religion need not be theocratic? Does anybody have any suggestions there? That Mises, on the one hand, seems to be saying, well, theocracy is claiming this kind of special, non-rational knowledge, but you could have, doesn't cover all of religion, but doesn't religion claim to have special knowledge? The answer is, so long as religion doesn't comment about social institutions or teaches views in accord with liberalism, there isn't any opposition between liberalism and religion. So Mises is saying, well, look, here's these theocracies that claim they have special insight into history, and that would be an opposition to classical liberalism, but as long as they don't say anything about social institutions, teach views that are in agreement with liberalism, there's no opposition between liberalism and religion. Now, one possibility I see, Mises didn't consider this a very unlikely one, is that there's some people could claim that they do have special non-rational knowledge of the trend of history, but that what this non-rational knowledge is telling them is that you should establish a free market, so then you could have a free market theocracy. There are actually people who perhaps hold that view, Reverend Rushdoony and his disciples at the Chalcedon Institute, theonomy, that sort of view actually does come close to this. Now, I think there's an objection. I think Bob has an interesting objection. He says you have to be careful so long as religion says nothing about the Third Reich. Well, remember, religion could say the Third Reich is bad and there wouldn't be any opposition between classical liberalism and religion. Now, what about Mises' own attitude toward religion? As I mentioned, he personally was an atheist, but at the same time, he's very sympathetic to the philosopher William James' individualist view of religion. James said religion is what a man does with his own solitude. So, according to James, religion is a personal transaction between the believer and a higher power, as the believer conceives of it. Mises liked this view because it rather keeps religion out of society, so it's not interfering with the classical liberal doctrines he favors. And elsewhere, for example, in his book Socialism, he suggests that early Christianity, at least as preached by Jesus, was of this form. He says Christianity was not an attempt to reform the world's political structure, but it was, he thinks the early Christians thought the world was coming to an end very soon, so what's important is the relationship between the individual believer and God. That was a popular view of Christianity at the time. He was writing a famous book by Albert Schweitzer on the quest for the historical Jesus. It was a very influential view, at least at that time. And there's still people who hold that, although it's controversial. I see there's a question here. Could a volunteer participation commune, which is run on theocratic lines, exist within a liberal society? Yes. I mean, as long as people didn't just kept it volunteer, I'm sure Mises would accept that. Now, I now want to turn from religion. We want to go back to the secular world. Want to deal now with one of the key points in Mises' entire system. We know that people benefit from social cooperation rather than living in isolation. You could imagine, say, a lot of people just decided we don't want anybody else around, we'll just exist by ourselves or in just very small groups, maybe families. Very few people would be alive for a long time if everybody tried that. The world just couldn't support a very large population if you didn't have large-scale society. Now, why is that? Why is it that people need other people in order to live? Why is it that people benefit from social cooperation? Well, one reason is that there's some task that only a group of people can perform. Supposing you wanted to build a skyscraper, you couldn't do it by yourself. It would be an impossible task. You have to get a large group of people to do that. We could think of things like if you look at the Stone Age people, say they want to go hunting, it might be very difficult for certain very large animals if you just hunted them by yourselves. It would be much better if you did this as a group than just individually. But all of this is important. There's some things that only groups can do and not individuals. Mises doesn't think this is the main reason society developed. He suggests that in primitive conditions, these tasks would come up only occasionally. So there'd be some tasks that we need groups of people to perform, maybe hunting or other things. But these would just come up from time to time. But society, as we know it, isn't just something that occurs now and then. We're in society full time. So in order to explain society, you have to come up with some activity that's really constant, that people are always doing. And we can't find, we don't find the answer to this in just thinking about what groups of people are required to do. So the answer is, you won't be surprised to learn, even if you haven't looked ahead at the next slides, is in the division of labor. Remember, we were talking about that in the previous lecture, is that people gain from specializing in production exchanging. So it wouldn't be a good idea, say, if I decided to grow my own food, I'd starve because I have no idea how to grow anything. I just fail completely. Much better if I do something else, like, just to pick something at random, give lectures on Austrian theory and then get the money I make from doing that and buying food. That would be much better for me. It will also be, say, people who grow food or people who sell food to me will probably benefit. They don't have to. They're better at doing those things, say, than they are about talking about Austrian theory. So people gain, we can see this is very common sense point of view, from production exchange. We each specialize in something, and then we trade what we produce with what other people are producing, and that way everybody benefits. So there are gains from trade. And Mises thinks recognizing gains from trade took place very early in history. This wasn't just something people came up with, say, in classical Greece or Rome. It was present even in the Stone Age, or as far back as we can go, people would be aware that they can benefit from exchanges with others. And this is the key fact in explaining why societies exist, why people get together and form societies. Remember, we were talking last time, I mentioned the paper by Joe Salerno, Mises as Social Rationalist. He thinks that the reason people get together in society is that they recognize it's to their advantage to do so. They don't have to think out consciously, we're going to form a society. They can see that trade with others is desirable in specialization, and there's no fixed limit to that. So that's how societies come about. Now, all right, so we know now division of labor is the key to why people get together in society. So, of course, the next thing to do, we have to discuss what explains division of labor. Why is it that division of labor is more productive than not having a division of labor? Why is it that specialization is such a good thing? Mises says the division of labor, Maurice says division of labor is the fact that people are not created equal in ability, or two sides of the same coin. Well, that's an interesting claim. That's a rather stronger claim than Mises is making. What Mises says is division of labor takes place because people aren't equal in their abilities, and also the areas of the earth are different, what the resources are in each part. Now, the claim that Murray is making, I don't even want to say that division of labor is just another way of saying that people are not created equal in ability, because we could imagine unequal people who don't engage in trade or specialization. Maybe they'd be better off if they did, or they probably would be, or almost certainly would be, but that if they don't, we can't say that division of labor is the same as unequal ability. And as we'll see in a few minutes, there's some people claim we could have division of labor without differences of ability, but Mises stresses that division of labor takes place because people aren't equal in their ability. So supposing, say, I'm better at giving lectures on Austrian economics and someone else is better at selling food, so we'll do better if we each specialize in what we're best at. And this explains why there is a division of labor. I should mention there's another view of a division of labor, which was taken by Adam Smith, that doesn't start from inequality. Remember, Mises is saying, look, people are all different, they have different abilities, resources, different parts of the earth are different. That's why we have division of labor. So Adam Smith and his successors say, oh, but look, supposing everybody's absolutely equal, and let's say the earth has identical combinations of resources in all areas, then they still find it beneficial to specialize. I see Ryan expresses this point, Adam Smith, even if we were all clones, there would still be division of labor. Yes, I think Smith would go along with that. Now, is this claim true? Well, it seems to depend on what we mean by equality, because supposing you start off with equal people and then one is specializing and producing, then you could count that as an inequality, possibly, that there one is specializing in one thing and one in some other. So it would really depend on what you mean by equality there, whether that claim is plausible. But if you accept it, I think it's clear that inequality makes division of labor much greater, so that most, at least nearly all division of labor seems to be based on unequal abilities and resources rather than same abilities and resources, but just people benefit through specialization. So Mises, I think, is basically right in what he thinks, even if you think there's something to this other view. Now, we now want to get into a very important topic to understand is called the law of association. This law arises from this possibility. We can see how trade is beneficial to two people if each person is better at producing something than the other one. So suppose I'm better than you in growing apples. Of course, that's a hypothetical example, because I couldn't grow apples at all. But suppose I'm better than you in growing apples, and you're better in growing oranges. So we can see that, say, I grow apples and you grow oranges, the total we come up with, the total apples plus oranges, will be more than if we each produce what we're best at making than if we each try to grow apples and oranges. We'll come up with a higher total if we each do what we're best at, because since we're better at it, we can do it better, we'll be able to grow more than the other one. I mean, you could come up with possible quibbles. There may be more better just means higher quality, but you could just make the necessary adjustments there to the example. In some way, we'll be better off if we each specialize in what we're best at rather than try to produce both goods ourselves, because then we'd be producing the one we're not as good at as well as the one in which we're superior. But interesting question comes up. Well, what happens if you're better at producing everything than I am, which is very likely to be the case? Now, I just see, before I get on to it, Anish asked an interesting point. Even if people were cloned, couldn't you induce inequality by spending more time doing one thing as opposed to another, leading one person being more skilled than another at doing a thing? Yes, that's an excellent point. That's one reason why I suggested that, possibility raised one reason I suggested that whether you think there's anything to this view of Smith would depend on what you characterize as equality. If you count learned behavior generating more skill as a type of inequality, then Smith's point wouldn't hold. Okay, so the question though that I want to raise now is, what if you're better at producing everything than I am? Will it still be beneficial for us to trade? Now, you might think it wouldn't be, because if you can do things better than I can, why would you want to get it from me? Why wouldn't you do the thing yourself, because you can do it better than I can? It would, why get an inferior performance from me? And it turns out that trade is beneficial even under this condition, namely that one trader is better at everything than the person that he's trading with. What you should do if you're better than at everything than the person you're trading with is you should specialize in the good where your absolute advantage is the greatest, and I should specialize where my absolute disadvantage is least. So supposing, say, you can grow both apples and oranges better than I can, but you're really spectacularly better than growing apples than I am, and somewhat better than growing oranges. So you should, we'd both be better off if you specialize in growing apples, the one you're much better than I am, and I grow oranges, and then we trade rather than you try to produce both of them. So what I should do, according to this law of associations, or called something called law of comparative cost, is specialize. If I'm worst off in everything, is that I should specialize where my absolute disadvantage is least. So supposing in my example, I'm not as good as you are at growing oranges, but my deficit there, the extent to which I'm bad, is not as much as my the difference between you and me in growing growing apples. There's a really big gap there, not as much in growing apples. So my absolute disadvantage is least in growing oranges. And this is called my comparative advantage. Why is it called comparative? Well, it need not be a real advantage. In fact, I'm not as good as you are in growing oranges, but I have a comparative advantage because my badness is least bad there. Now, this expression is often misused or misunderstood. For example, I've seen in reviews people talk about say they don't think a particular writer is very intelligent, so they'll say, well, skill in argument isn't his comparative advantage, meaning he's not very good at it. The person, comparative advantage, would just be being used sometimes as meaning what the person is good at. But this isn't what the term means in economics. It just means where your disadvantage is least. Of course, if you're better in everything, it would be your comparative advantage would be where your advantage over everybody is greatest. So it's your most, your comparative advantage is your most productive activity in a particular trade, whether this is because you're better at it than other people or you're worse, but the extent to which you're worse is less than with other things. So it's very important. Comparative advantage doesn't have to be that you're better than the person you're trading with. It's just if you're not better, it's your the extent to which you're worse is less than other things. Now, so we said, well, this is what you should do, but how we know that's true? I mean, it's not just true because I say it or because Mises said, how we know it's true that the person superior should specialize in what he's best at rather than produce both goods by himself. Well, the easiest way to grasp why the law is true is just to consider some examples. Now, let's imagine there's a baseball player who's very skilled in making baseball bats. He might find it more beneficial to buy a bat from someone less skilled because then he can concentrate on playing baseball and he'll earn more money. So even if he's better at making baseball bats than the other person, he'll be to his advantage to concentrate on playing baseball where he's much better off than the other person and then will earn a higher salary. Now notice, in trying to explain why this law is true, why if you have someone who's superior in all products to the person he's trading with, why he should specialize in producing what he's best at and just trade with the other person where the other person is least bad. The difficult part is to explain why trade helps the person with the absolute advantage in all the areas. Now, if you want to ask, why should the person who is worse in both areas trade? That's pretty easy to understand because since the other person is better, he's going to be getting more of the good, more of the good that he wants will be produced than if he tried to do it himself, so we can see why he would want to trade. But the hard part is to explain why the person who's more skilled would want to trade with someone who's less skilled. Now there's an exception to this law. Remember, the law is that if someone is more skilled in everything than the person he's trading with, he's more productive in everything, it's still beneficial for him to trade with this person who's not as good as he is. There's one case where trade between people where one has an absolute advantage in all areas is not better for all. It's in this case occurs when someone's absolute advantage isn't greater in one area than another. So you can see why this is true, because the claims I've given it is that it's beneficial for a trade to take place if somebody is worse off in producing, say, both goods than someone else, but his not as bad in producing one of them as he is in producing the other. So the gap is more in one than the other. So then it's to the advantage of both people if he specializes in producing where the gap is least. But if the gap is the same in both places, this argument doesn't apply. But this situation doesn't come up very often in practice. So in almost all cases, trade between people where one is superior to the other in all the products is better. Now, here, next time we're going to get into a question that Kevin has asked. The law of association was one of the pioneers in developing this, David Ricardo, according to Murray Rothbard's History of Economic Thought, Ricardo's friend James Mill had really developed the law before he did. But Ricardo is the one that this law of association comparative cost is generally associated with. And Ricardo showed the law held in international trade. And his model holds fixed capital and labor in two countries so that capital and labor can't be moved from one country to the other. And the question Kevin raises, well, what's the point? Why is this an important point about mobility of capital and labor? And the reason for this in Ricardo's model is, well, if you don't have mobility of capital, if you allow mobility of capital and labor, then they would just move to where they're most productive. And the reason he wants to hold that they can't, he puts in that they can't be moved is just so he can show that trade is beneficial, even if one country is producing the goods less efficiently than the other, all the goods, that trade is still beneficial. Now, there's some people who objected to the free trade conclusions that some people have drawn from Ricardo, the law of comparative cost. They say all Ricardo showed is that trade is beneficial under restricted conditions. But according to those critics, there isn't a general argument for free trade. So supposing you say capital and labor aren't fixed, or supposing the products in one country aren't produced less efficiently than all the products in the other. So, well, Ricardo's law doesn't apply in that case. But this is a misunderstanding because we know that trade is always beneficial from the point of view of those engaged in it. So what Ricardo is doing is just dealing with a special case and saying trade is beneficial even in this case, but we shouldn't say, well, since this is a special case, then we don't have a general argument that free trade is good. It's that we do have the general argument that free trade is good as long as both parties want to engage in the trade. And that Ricardo is just trying to deal with a special case where you might at first think it isn't beneficial. An important point Mises makes is that the law doesn't just apply to Ricardo's case of trade between two countries. And in fact, when I was explaining this law of association, I was giving it with just examples of two people. I didn't put it as a case of international trade, even though that was the way Ricardo developed the law. So this law of association, the general law, applies to any exchange between people, with that exception I noted, where, say, someone is inferior in all the products to the other person, exactly the same proportion. But unless you have that case, people will benefit from trade even if somebody is inferior to the person he's trading with and producing everything, as long as he's not inferior in exactly the same proportion. And this law of association is basic to Mises' theory of society. And he said, well, we all benefit from trade and specialization, division of labor. This is why society is formed. And even if there are people who aren't better than anybody else in producing anything, will still be to people's advantage to trade with them. Now, one point I want to go into, and this will be the last thing I'll mention, is how does Mises prove this law? He says, this law of association. His proof of law, I must say, I found the passage where he discusses this numerical example a bit compressed and a bit confusing, so I didn't want to go into this. Let me just get this one question. Galt says, if two parties each have absolute advantage, there's no absolute advantage. Or if only one has absolute advantage, everything, there's a comparative advantage. Is this correct? Not exactly. No. If you could have cases where one person has an absolute advantage in one thing and another person has an comparative advantage. Each party has comparative advantage. There's no absolute advantage. No, that wouldn't follow because both the person who has the absolute advantage would have a comparative advantage, namely the one he's best at, and the one who is worst at everything has a comparative advantage where he's least bad. So I think that's the thing to remember. So as I say, Mises, this numerical example he gives it, I found a bit compressed and confused. Of course, it's not as bad as my elections, but that's not a very high standard. But what Mises is doing, really, in his proof, is taking account of the cost of alternatives, taking his physical quantities produced in a certain amount of time. So what he's basically saying is that if the person with the absolute advantage tried to produce the good where his advantage over the other one is least, he'd be giving up more of the other good than proportionately than the person who's least bad would be giving up in producing that. So the opportunity cost is higher if you produce for the one who has the advantage in both in producing the good where his advantage is least. As I hope you see, that's very convoluted, but you don't have to really worry about that because you can just grasp the law as true by just looking at these these money calculations. That's the easy way. You just come up with these examples like the one I gave about the baseball player ones that people give, say, a doctor finding it profitable to employ a secretary or a nurse, the doctor is better, say, in secretarial or nursing skill than the person he employed. But as I say, Mises gives this rather convoluted, at least I found a convoluted proof, and I haven't been able to explain that in a very simple way, but you don't have to worry about that. But a point you should note is that Mises makes is he doesn't want to come up with a proof of law by calculating directly in subjective values and saying, well, we can show by appeal to subjective theory of value that trade is beneficial in these cases covered by the law of association. Because the fundamental point, there's no calculation directly in value. You can have monetary calculation, but not calculation directly in value. So I think I've said enough confusing things about law of association, so I think we'll stop here. We can go on for questions and comments. And I see Garth says, what would Mises say about a natural right to self-defense? Well, remember, Mises is not one who goes in for natural rights. And so he wouldn't use that language. I think he would think, somebody, Kevin says, is a loaded question. Like, I suppose if a person trying to exercise his right self-defense has a gun, it would be loaded, probably. So I think Mises wouldn't talk in such terms. He would think people should be legally protected against assault on them, but I don't think he'd talk that way. Now, John says, if two parties each have absolute advantage, then there is no comparative advantage. No, that wouldn't follow, you see, because each would have an absolute advantage in whatever it was best at, and then they would also have a the person would have a comparative advantage also. Because a comparative advantage doesn't have to be a situation where somebody's bad at worse at producing something than somebody else, but not as bad in one good than another. You could have a comparative advantage if you're better than somebody else in producing something. Now, then the next phrase, however, if only one has absolute advantage in everything, then there's a comparative advantage. No, because you could have a comparative advantage in the other case. Say if I'm better at producing apples and you're better at producing oranges and we trade apples for oranges, then each of us has an absolute advantage in respectively apples and oranges, and we each have a comparative advantage in that also. But the easy way to remember that, just comparative advantage, what it's best for you to produce considering what the other person is that you're trading with is producing, and that can have an answer if you're better at one thing than the other person. The other person is better at something else, and it has also has an answer if you're one person is worse in both things than the other. Now, Colin says, is there such a thing as intrinsic value? Where does Mises talk about this thing? Well, the second part of your question is much easier to answer than the first. Mises does not believe in intrinsic value, where an intrinsic value would be, I take it, something that would be valuable regardless of people's attitudes toward it, so one could say, even nobody thought that a particular work of art was valuable, it still is intrinsically beautiful. That would be an example of some of the intrinsic value. But Mises doesn't accept that. He thinks that all values are subjective. He doesn't believe in intrinsic value. Now, whether he's correct or not, that's a very difficult question. I'd be inclined to think maybe he's not, but it's not the, I don't think I want to, this is the best thing to get into. Now, here's a question here. Let me just get this one from Tim. I understand the notion of comparative advantage when apples and oranges are involved. I just skipped the question. What about when growing bananas is also possible? Who would grow the extra fruit? How is this decided? Well, I didn't deal with questions where there are more than two goods, but basically you can see how that would be settled in the same way as with the two good case, because there we would have to say you'd have to compare the advantage, say, one person would have in growing bananas, how much better one person was in growing bananas than the other. So it would just complicate the calculations a little bit, but it wouldn't change anything. We'd still have to ask, what is the comparative advantage, assuming bananas can be grown in both places? Now, if you're thinking, case one, bananas are grown in one rather than the other, then there'd be, we'd have, then the person would just have to decide how much, it would just figure out how much growing bananas would benefit him as opposed to trading for other things. I mean, a case wouldn't come up, the law of association would come up, unless the good could be produced in both places. Now, Leslie says, I think some historians see the Oregon site coming from common tasks people in the group had to do, such as build and maintain irrigation system. What means is, say, this view of the Oregon site. I don't think he ever commented on Rick Vogel specifically. Now, Rick Vogel sees particular types of social organization called hydraulic societies coming about through where irrigation systems especially important. But remember, in those societies, we've already got a society to start with. And it's just how did what he calls Oriental despotism develop? That was the title of his famous book on this stuff. So he's concerned more with a later stage of social development than Mises is. I don't think Mises ever commented on it. I think it's consistent. But Vogel says consistent with what Mises is saying, because Mises just opposed the view that common tasks explain how society really started and what's holding it together. You think it's more, no, it's division of labor. But you could hold the view, yes, it's division of labor, but these common tasks account for this kind of special Oriental despotism, or this special kind of proto-totalitarian order. Now, Anish says it's required meaningful or technical correctness in original formulation in the sense that it treats the entire country as an actor when this violates methodological individualism. No, I don't think it would, because you can certainly talk about countries doing things consistently with methodological individualism, but it would just be explainable in terms of individual action, say, in the case Ricardo gives. I think it's you would just have the countries would be trained that those trades would be consistent individual traders who are making exchanges. So I don't think he's guilty of any violation of methodological individualism there. At least I'm not seeing why he would be. Now, is it, Eduardo says, is it correct to affirm that comparative advantage rests on respect for property rights? If this is the case, how does Mises justify property rights? Is it based on his utilitarian ethic? Well, comparative advantage really is just involves cases where one person is trading with another person. As long as they're trading, that's sufficient for the case to come in. They wouldn't, I mean, presumably if they're trading, they probably would have a notion of property rights, but they wouldn't have to have the view. I mean, they could trade with each other. Have you, well, it would be even better if I could just steal what the other guy's produce for myself, but I don't think I can get away with it. So you wouldn't have to respect property rights for the theorem of comparative advantage to hold. And of course, Mises' justification of property rights is based on his utilitarian system. He's saying, well, people can cooperate, they'll gain much more than they would if they tried to use force to take what they wanted from other people. But comparative advantage isn't dependent on particular views people take of property rights. And John said, if two people are to produce the exact same amount of everything, there's no comparative advantage or absolute advantage. is this correct? Yes, I think that would be right. Now, here's one from Anish. The special case where comparative advantage doesn't exist is where the more productive person considers the comparative difference equal in value. It's not a matter of equal, somebody considering somebody equal in value. It's more a matter of what each one can produce. Say, when you say, suppose I say, you're better at growing oranges than I am, that wouldn't be a matter of how you or I value oranges. It would be just more of a matter of who can grow them better. It would be a physical comparison. So the case where comparative advantage doesn't exist is, let's imagine there are two goods, apples and oranges. You're better at producing both of them than I am, better in this physical sense. You can just grow more of them with the same quality than I can. But the extent to which you're better in both of them is exactly the same. It isn't that I'm worse than you in both, but there's one where I'm less bad. It's that I'm equally worse in both of them. Does absolute advantage only refer to the individual's comparative advantage between individuals? No. I mean, absolute advantage is, these are all comparisons with persons you're training. They're always comparative. Absolute advantage means you're better at producing a good than the person you're trading with. If comparative advantage means either you're better than the other person or you're less bad at producing the good than you are at producing some other good that both of you produce. So comparative advantage, either way you remember that, comparative advantage can be an absolute disadvantage, but it doesn't have to be. Here's one, Anisha. So it could be that the more productive person is better by different physical amounts of each good. We value all those differences equally, at least in distinctly different on his scale of values. My question is comparative advantage finally subjective phenomenon? That's an excellent question. What Mises is, no, it's not. What Mises is interested is the physical productivity. He says, just like in the law of returns, where he says certain combinations of goods would be more productive than other combinations producing particular commodity. What he's interested in is not how people subjectively regard these physical amounts, but simply who is better at producing something than the other person. Now, Collins says, each person specializes in goods to produce more efficiently, total output, both goods would rise and both would benefit from trade. Yes, that's right. The law of association is dealing with where trade would be beneficial even if someone can't produce a good as efficiently as the person he's trading with. Oh, now Anisha, he was referring to a case where a comparative advantage doesn't apply to special case. No, that one, again, is just purely physical also. It's that doesn't depend on how people view these, say the apples and oranges, but just say you're better at producing apples and oranges than I am, but exactly the same proportion. So then we can't apply the law of association there. Oh, no. And he says, okay, got it. Oh, good. I'm glad you get it, because I certainly don't. I wish. Yeah, this is confusing. Now, Bob is, Lefty said, the reading by Stan Schmidt was helpful. Yes, I think that's a very, very good. And that's especially helpful in explaining what Mises is getting it at by his numerical example. If you do it in terms of opportunity cost, I think it makes it much easier to understand, because what the difficulty is, in going to the lecture, is that in Mises' numerical example, if people specialize, you'll come up with, they'll have less total of one good and more of the other. And Mises wants to say that's a larger physical quantity than if they, what you get if they both produced both. And it's not clear how he can say it's a larger physical quantity if there's less of one good and more of the other than if they both people produce both. But if you do it in terms of opportunity cost, then I think it becomes, you can understand what Mises is saying. But don't, I'm glad I don't have to take a quiz on that example. I mean, that I don't think I got this perfectly clear, that example here in my own mind. I think I get some of the basics, but that's why I said, but you don't really have to concentrate on that rather convoluted example to get what Mises was after in this law. Now, contrary, if you talk to people in comparative advantage trade, wouldn't we know that they benefit because they trade? Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, that's why they're trading, but if they're trading, that wouldn't tell you whether they're trading because one is better in producing one thing, the other one is better in producing the other thing, or whether one person is better in both, but the person he's trading with is less bad in one thing than the other thing. Now, Bowser said trade restriction will mess everything up. Yes, I think Mises would certainly go along with that. Remember that he would try to show that you could show without making value judgments that trade restrictions will not achieve what they're supposed to from the point of view of those who favor them. And Constant Mises, this is the origin of society. Yes, I mean, this is one of his basic claims. He thinks that society is to be explained by people recognizing they benefit from trade. It's very much a view of society based on rational self-interest. Of course, there are a lot of people who don't accept this, but this is the view he's very strongly in favor of. This is what you should, if you haven't already, look at that article by Joe Salerno, Mises as social rationalist. Now, childhood modern mercantilist. Yes, I think a lot of the current policies are very similar to mercantilist policies that have been pursued by the in early modern Europe, where the state tried to regulate trades, they promote money coming into the country. There's Murray Rothbard did a very interesting article, I think it came out in the Freeman around 1963, on the relation between mercantilism and contemporary ideas. I have to look up the exact time. I remember it came out around 63 or so. I remember reading it at the time. I will still have a few minutes in case anyone else has something. I'll try to, money, the state, modern mercantilism. Yes, I think that's the one, yes. Now, as far as any guess on why the human race lived for so long in primitive communes? Well, there, you see, your question involves a rather controversial assumption that the human race did live on primitive communism for a long time. That, of course, was the view that Engels had, you know, origins of family, private property, and the state. But Mises, I don't think, would accept that view at all. That in Mises' view, primitive communism wouldn't really be a sustainable system. So I think he didn't hold the view. So your question on why the human race lived for so long on primitive communism would be it didn't. Now Ryan says primitives that exist today are the ones that did not develop, and they should not be used as a model of what we once were. Well, that's a very good point you raised, Ryan. And that, in fact, was a point that Murray Rothbard made, that we shouldn't claim that so-called primitive societies today are examples of what we were like in primitive times ourselves. Because remember, those primitive societies are ones that have developed in time also. Now, you know, it's funny, Gene Callahan had a post once on his blog saying, oh, look how incredibly silly Rothbard was, because he thought that you can't look at a primitive society today and think it's like primitive societies in the past. But of course Rothbard was right. Rothbard was making a point that's very well understood in contemporary anthropology. But it was funny that Gene Callahan would say, oh, look how silly Rothbard is for saying it, but it would seem like a perfectly true point. Now, Anisha, the ancient primitive societies, the ones the most unproductive in the fertile parts of the world, which agricultural settlers didn't want to settle or use. Well, that strikes me as a plausible conjecture, but I have to look into that to know whether it was, see what the contemporary state of opinion is. I mean, you could well be, I mean, Ryan points out that Amazon is not infertile. Yes, that's a good point, although it might be there are other aspects of that area that make it hard to settle. But it's a good point. Well, I guess, Laurie says both Latin America. Well, I guess, thanks everybody. So I guess we're out of time now. And I see Travis knows Rothbard's article very well. Okay, so we'll see you next week. Remember, the lecture will be Wednesday rather than Tuesday because I'll still be traveling back from the Mises Conference. Okay, thanks everybody. Oh, Jeff's going to the conference. Good. Okay, thank you. Bye everybody.